This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
At a glance of April Ryan's career, there's so much to see and far too many accomplishments to mention, but here's the tip of the iceberg. April Ryan is a 30-year journalism veteran, an esteemed member of the National Press Club, and has covered three presidents as the White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks. Rolling. Not one to bury headlines, many of April Ryan's breaking news stories and interviews have been featured in television newscasts on ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC, and Fox, and also have found their way to the pages of some of the nation's top newspapers. In 2008, April Ryan conducted an exclusive interview with President Bush in the Oval Office about America's international policy with African countries. In 2009, Ryan traveled to Mexico and Trinidad with President Obama. April also traveled aboard Air Force One and interviewed President and Mrs. Bush while flying to the Gulf Coast for the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And because being a reporter isn't enough for her dynamic acumen, Ryan has appeared as a roundtable panelist on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, analyzed the changing political climate with the Obama era on NBC's Today Show, gone head-to-head with Chris Matthews et al., discussing hot topics on MSNBC's Hardball, and has been a regular contributor Sunday nights with Don Lemon on CNN, and a regular panelist on TV1's Washington's Watch with Roland Martin. Despite noting all of these accomplishments, I have buried a major headline about April Ryan. She's a mother. A proud mother of two daughters, which in part is why we're here tonight to discuss her new book, At Mama's Knee, Mothers and Race in Black and White. Written from the point of view of a mother's worldview, At Mama's Knee is a series of essays and autobiographical sketches that examines what it means for mothers to enable themselves, their children, and by default, the world, to constructively engage race and racism festering in our modern day society. Goodreads praises At Mama's Knee, saying Ryan's journalistic chops are evident in her keen eye for an important topic, and she also shows a willingness to stake out strong and even unpopular opinions. Ain't that a real mother for you? Please join me in welcoming April Ryan.
I feel so welcomed always at Politics and Prose, and good evening, everyone. Wow, I have a lot of friends from far and near, from Baltimore. I'm telling you, it's in just politics and prose, and I want my fellow White House compadres that I've known for 20 years to raise your hand. They're out showing, yes, thank you. Thanks, ladies. I have folks that work with me in a lot of ways to help me look halfway decent when I'm talking to you anywhere I talk. But I thank you all for coming out tonight. It's a very big night tonight. There's going to be an announcement tonight at 8 o'clock. And I want someone to let me know what that announcement is, because I hear it's going to be kind of apprentice-esque, but nonetheless. Well, you know, first of all, I'm a White House correspondent for the American Urban Radio Networks, and I'm so thankful to have celebrated 20 years January 13th. I'm now covering four presidents. I still feel like I'm 17, so that's a good thing. But in the midst of all of that, I became a mother a couple of years ago, about maybe 14 years ago, during that process as a White House correspondent. And this latest book, my second book baby after this one, you can tell this is kind of like my Bible, the first one, The Presidency in Black and White. A year later, this one came out. And this was born out of the unrest in Baltimore. And I am a child of Baltimore. I am a product of Baltimore City. I frequent areas where Freddie Gray was taken into custody. I go get my hair done around the place where Freddie Gray once walked. I go to church in some of those areas. So as you see me at the White House, I'm still very much in the community. And this book was born out of this, but really it was born out of a mother who had to tell her daughter or her daughters or mothers who had to tell their children about issues of race. It was an organic conversation, but a conversation nonetheless that I think that we need to have today. And this book is an attempt to try to help us navigate these murky waters, because right now these waters are very murky. It seems like the other is having a problem today in this country. So 2 years ago or so, my daughter, who's 9 years old, Grace, my children love to be outside. They're like any kid. What happens is they want to go outside. They want to play with their Nerf cannon, soft tip gun. They want to play with their archery set. And we went outside. Well, they went outside. And my Aunt Pearl, who watches them, said, and I was at the White House, come back inside. And Gracie was like, no, Mommy. No, well, no, Aunt Pearl, why? Why should I come in? And then she said, because a little boy was killed. A little boy was killed for playing with a toy gun. Now, imagine my backyard. It's a backyard that's large, and it has an open field behind it, and there are no fences. So, and you can see from the street into the backyard. So my aunt was very concerned about my daughter and the possibilities of something happening. And that's the reality today. So she did not, in her little 7-year-old mind at the time, understand what the reality was, what really was telling in the news, what was happening. So what we did was, when I came home, she said, Mommy, is it true? Mommy, is it true? I said, Gracie, yes, it's true. The unfortunate piece, I had to give her the truth. She didn't believe me. I had to show my 7-year-old the video of Tamir Rice being killed by a police officer, shot dead, holding a toy gun in a park in Cleveland, Ohio. It's true, because this is the reality that I have to deal with. And that was my first conversation with my child about race. You know, you want to give your children sugar and spice and everything nice, particularly for girls. But the realities of life hit us and hit us hard. So then after that, there were more issues. I'm like, how can I sit at the White House, ask issues about race, of presidents, of the principals, and not deal with it in my own home? So then I'll never forget the day. I'm sitting in my little booth the size of 2 phone booths put together at the White House. And the next thing you know, yes, it's the size of 2 phone booths put together. Claustrophobics need not apply. So I'm sitting in my booth and I'm watching my city. I'm watching rock throwing. I'm watching hurt. And I'm in tears. And I'm like, okay, it's down there. It's not going to come my way. Well, guess what? There was a concern that it was going to come my way. My children were 11.5 miles away from the rock throwing. And parents were calling me. My aunt was calling me. Friends were calling me, get home now. I left the White House. The closer to home I drove, the harder it was to get to my children. Imagine that. You are just feet from the President of the United States, and you don't know if there's Armageddon going on in your hometown. So in the meantime, a young lady, another mother, picked up my children for me, which was one of the best things that could have happened. Another mother who had a heart to understand that I was in a bad situation. So the school didn't tell the kids why they were ending school at the time they were. They didn't tell the kids why there were going to be no after school programs. The kids just went home. So I pick up my daughters, and you know, parents, if you're parents or aunties or what have you, you cannot shelter in place with children without their snacks. So so here's what happened. So I said, okay, we're not far from the store. So we picked up a couple of things, and then we went home thinking that it's going to die down, but it just kept going that night. It escalated. So I said, the next day I'm going to stay home from work. I'm going to work from home, still being maybe 15 miles away or so from where all the activity was happening. So I stay home. We get a call the middle of the day. the children are going to be let out of school early. There's not going to be any afternoon programs because the fear was that they were coming out to us. There were helicopters, police with drawn guns in our community. They shut down doctor's offices. They shut down stores. They shut down the McDonald's and the Chick-fil-A. Now, yeah, that you know that it's a problem then. So again, knowing that if you shelter in place, you got to go to the store. So we went to the store again. This time, as we're walking out, and I said, you know, get everything that you need. And I was telling them what was going on. But really what was the exclamation point on that moment was when we were leaving the store and I was in my mommy mobile, my minivan. My oldest daughter was in the front of the car, and she and I both saw this truck going through this maze in the parking lot. And it was a red pickup truck. And there were two flags in the back of the truck brandishing in the wind. One of the flags happened to be a Confederate flag. It was like dousing oil on the fire. Tensions were raw. So my oldest daughter said, Mommy, what is that? I said, look, sweetie. I said, this is called a Confederate flag. And I said, while we were driving, and as my reporter hat came on and my reporter hands took the wheel with my reporter foot put a little bit more gas on the pedal to catch up with the truck, I said, this is a sign of hate and a sign of a dark past. And as I was driving fast to catch up and pull my phone out to take a picture, she started to cry. But it was organic, but we needed to navigate the waters to let them know. As my child attends a predominantly white, wealthy school, and the kids were talking. So how can I discuss matters of race at the White House for America and not talk about it in my own home? So going through this, the publisher said, wait a minute, April's from Baltimore. April's a woman. April's a mother. April's got children. Because they saw what was happening, and they also saw that woman in that viral video save her son. Corporal punishment, but she saved her son from the streets, from the police. These are conversations that we need to have. And I want to start this reading off with something from March 7th. For those of you who have the book, March 7th, 2015, on board Air Force One, we were flying down with President Obama, then President Obama, to Selma, Alabama. And I had asked him a question about, quote unquote, post-racial versus post-Obama era. And he said, I would not equate my election with seminal moments like the Emancipation Proclamation or the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Those were massive changes in legal status that represented fundamental breaks in America's tragic history and were the pillars, the 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, and 15th Amendment of Civil Rights Acts of the 60s. Those represented the dismantling of formal discrimination in this country. There's nothing that's going to compare to that. Moving forward, our work is to build on that work, to fine-tune that work, where we see formal discrimination or state-sponsored discrimination still occurring. But increasingly, our work has to do with dealing with the ongoing legacy of a divided society. Closing the opportunity gaps, closing the achievement gaps, closing the wealth gaps that inevitably have been passed on from generation to generation because the gaps were so wide. And that involves no one piece of legislation, but it requires a host of different efforts. It means investing in early childhood education. It means us making sure everybody has health insurance. It means that kind of public-private work that we're doing through My Brother's Keeper. It means getting more African Americans in STEM education, in math and science and engineering. And so there's not going to be one silver bullet, but rather it's going to be a sustained effort on a variety of fronts that will take us to the next leg of this journey towards a more just society. Wow. That was on our way to Selma, Alabama for the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. And those words still ring true today. But again, who are we? So this book really goes into the heart of the matter. When you talk about race, and this is kind of piggybacking off of what President Obama said, then President Obama. And isn't it strange to say then President Obama? It's just been 10 days or 11 days. I don't know. I can't even keep count now. But the bottom line is that we still have a society that is divided. And I'm going to think about, I'm going to go back to something, my children's favorite singer, Leslie Odom Jr., in the song called Seriously, where we are a united, divided states. So when it comes to matters of race, African Americans still have the highest numbers of negatives in almost every category. And issues of policing are very important. That's one of the pieces where I start in this book. Traditionally, in the African American community, the American Black community, there is an instinctive coming of age truth for our young Black men called the talk. It's something Black fathers or father figures give their sons or equivalents. It's meant to be a lifetime tool that might help these boys strategically navigate interactions with law enforcement with the ultimate goal of avoiding altercations. The talk can spell life or death for some Black males. I know it sounds so 1950s and 60s, but now more than ever, that's the reality in the modern age, more than 60 years later. The essence of the talk is a dad telling his son in blunt terms that some bad policing results in death for our Black men and boys. Be it intentional or unintentional, it is more than a soulful truth. It's an unavoidable fact in our communities. When I was on the tour promoting my first book, The Presidency in Black and White, I was amazed at how white people responded to a May 30th, 2015 Washington Post newspaper article detailing the number of murders of Black males by police. The story was titled Fatal Police Shootings in 2015, Approaching 400 Nationwide. Those statistics represented just the first few months of 2015, not even 6 months. In Charlottesville, Virginia, a questioner asked me if I was shocked by the stats in that article. I said very nonchalantly, no. The questioner was stunned by my attitude and approach to his question. Seeing his amazement, I explained, I am the daughter of a Black man and the sister of a Black man. I also admitted that I had myself been racially profiled by police. We call it driving while Black. This experience is so common in Black life that it's referred to as DWB. More than anything, yes it is, more than anything, I'm part of the Black community that consistently beats the drum when those crimes happen. We express our pain and hurt through talking and spreading the stories. And at the same time, we try to come to grips with the inconceivable pain that happens over and over again in our communities. And what this book does, it puts a spotlight on the real issues of race from a mother's standpoint, or people who have heard from their mother. And, you know, in this book, I talked to President Obama, then President Obama, I got to do it, then former President Obama, who talked about his mother and how she explained what it was to be Black in this society and to be a Black man. I talked to so many parents, to include Congressman John Lewis, whose mother was actually against him being in the civil rights movement. And this book focuses on women because we are the first influencer, we are the first teacher. And if you look at stats, stats show we are also increasing in number as the head of household, increasing in number as the sole provider in the household. So therefore the talk is now transfigured from a man to a woman. And it's not just from a man to the son, but it's also a woman to the son and daughter. So it's changed. And how are our perceptions about race? And you can legislate, going back to what President Obama said, you can legislate, but after a while, it's about the heart. If the heart and the mind line up, things change. And it comes from that most sacred place. What are you telling your children about race? Are you guys having these conversations with children that you influence? What are you telling your children about race? And I'm gonna go to Congressman John Lewis really fast. As a young John Lewis was pressing for the mark of first-class citizenship for Blacks, his mother was not in support of this. There may be a clear explanation for Miss Lewis's attitude and for other mothers. They didn't want their children on the front lines, almost making them the sacrificial lambs for our equality. President Obama's spiritual advisor, Joshua Dubois, the former head of the Obama administration's faith-based initiative and the CEO of Value Partnerships, finds mothers are the ones who have to bear the greatest burden of heartbreak, really. At the end of the day, when our people are enduring the things we have endured, it is the mothers that are the primary carers. carriers of the emotional burden in that way. We have seen that from slavery to Reconstruction, and I would even say I am sure that the mothers today, from Trayvon Martin's mother to Michael Brown's mother, have been at the forefront of these movements. This movement, the civil rights movement, the most successful movement in this nation's history for change, did not have the support of the masses. Some doors were even closed to young people seeking liberty for all. At the time, a very small minority of churches supported the movement. Congressman Lewis affirmed what black leaders have said, that only 4% of black churches supported Dr. King during that movement. So I'm going to fast forward with something with Congressman Lewis. It's interesting. His mother was so vehemently against him marching with Dr. King. She was vehemently against him going to Troy State, which he wanted to do, he did not do. Because Dr. King, who called him the boy from Troy, told the family who were sharecroppers, who purchased their 300 acres of land for 100, no, excuse me, their 100 acres of land, their 100 acres of land for $300. Dr. King told the Lewis family that their home could be bombed, they could lose their land. And think of that, at that time, for black people to have land like that, to have 100 acres of land not stolen, 100 acres of land and lose it because you want to change the dynamic, you want to shift the atmosphere in southern Alabama. So she was totally against it, but guess what? He marched, he was bruised, he was bloodied, he marched. He got the Civil Rights Act. She still wasn't for that, but guess what? It took him and the others in that movement to help create the atmosphere for Lyndon Johnson to support the Voting Rights Act. And that's when the Voting Rights Act was passed, that's when Mrs. Lewis decided, okay, I'm with you. Not only did she say she was with him, but what she did, she walked in her action and walked in her talk. She literally started registering people to vote herself to show that she was in support. So these are some of the stories. You know, I talk in this book to people like Sabrina Fulton, the mother of Trayvon Martin, Gwen Carr, the mother of Eric Garner, who was choked to death by police in New York City. He screamed out 11 times, "I can't breathe." This book has President Obama in it. This book has the Deo man, Harry Belafonte, you know, talking about his mother and how he said he was an activist before he was an entertainer. And his mother told him, never see an inequity and not go and fix it. So we are influencers as women. We are leaders as women. I even talked to Hillary Clinton. Speaking of a leader, well, she's a leader. She didn't make it as president, but she's still a leader. And she talked about how her mother influenced her. How her mother, when she was a kid, in her church, and the youth minister said, okay, Dr. King is coming to town. And her mother said, you must go because he's a great man and he's trying to make change in this country, needed change. But in the church, some of the white parents said, no, I'm not going to do it. She was one of those who attended the service. So I encourage you to read the pages. I encourage you to really listen to the heart of mothers. And there's another piece in here that I want to share with you. A mother who is one of the most recognized mothers in this country, or you, some would say she is, but Valerie Jarrett and I had a conversation. Former advisor to President Barack Obama and best friend of Michelle Obama and former President Barack Obama. We talk about the importance of women, but when we drill down for African-American women, I'm going to read this to you, and then I'm going to open it up to questions. Now imagine a true life story of a black woman who has achieved the ultimate titanium ring in 21st century Washington, D.C. She's one of the most influential and recognizable people of any gender, race, or any status is confronted not only by the physical condition of being unseen, but she was also in the crosshairs of the racist and jaded mental situations of being unnoticed. An extreme but very real example during the Obama administration years. First Lady Michelle Obama would leave the secure bubble of the White House, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, her home at the time, to venture out for walks and exercise, fulfilling her personal agenda of her Let's Move campaign. She would walk the streets of Washington, D.C., around the White House, unannounced and in most cases unnoticed. She was rarely recognized, and because of that fact, the unpublished walks continued. She walked by everyday America, workers, tourists, and residents. But for the most part, she took long walks away from the White House without any fanfare from those she encountered along the way. This beautiful and statuesque woman, the wife of the leader of the free world, was not recognized. This tall, accomplished woman was nearly invisible to all those who unknowingly encountered her during her walks. Valerie Jarrett, Mrs. Obama's friend, dating back decades from Chicago, would take these walks with her. Jarrett says this makes the point what African-American women experience every day. So if you don't notice her, you certainly aren't going to notice other African-American women. Jarrett reminds us how Mrs. Obama has been impactful in her duties as First Lady, mother, and human being, and that has caused everyone to take another look. And with that, thank you. I want to thank you. This book is very dear to my heart because I pulled out a lot of stuff from my personal experiences. And one thing I will tell you that my mother always told me, it's not what they call you, it's what you answer to. Yeah. And my mother is gone to glory now, but I still keep her wisdom and I try to bring it to my children and other young girls that I encounter. So with that, I would love to open it up with questions, and I thank you. Don't be shy. Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for your presentation and your thoughts.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you a question as a mother. I serve on a board that was confronted with instances of racial tension on a campus, a college campus, a white college campus. This mother, a white woman, said, "I feel so chagrined about that because when I look at my own children and how they navigate their way through society, they don't see race."
And that's a good thing.
How would you as a mother ingest that comment and respond to it to a white woman who told you as a mother, "Well, you know, my children don't see race"?
You know what? There's a very wise woman who's here with me, one of my dearest and best friends, Dr. Martha Kumar, who said something. Yeah, I'm calling you out, Dr. Kumar. She's also the author of a book, a couple of books, some great books. She said something to me. I was complaining to her about something. Someone was having these moments. And she said, "Do you know something?" And she marched with Dr. King. She marched with a lot of people to help create a just society for all people. And she said, "That's what we marched for." And I said, "You know what? You're right." But the thing of it is, they don't understand it. They don't see, they don't feel the racial issue, but they need to know the history to guard against it. They need to understand the history. My mother always taught me, whenever I drove or she drove somewhere or something, she would say, "You know that traffic light was made by a black man." I'm like, "Okay, mommy." And then she would say, "The gas mask is made by a black." I'm like, "Why is she telling me about a gas mask? Who knew that I was gonna need one?" I would carry one at the White House. I used to carry one to the White House all the time. It was right after 9/11. My friends don't remember that. And then, you know, when we would sit at the kitchen table and we might have some peanuts or something, she said, "You know how many uses there are of a peanut in George Washington cover?" I'm like, but you know, those things mean something because she taught me the pride of who I come from. I'm five generations removed from the last known slave in my family, and none of them would have ever imagined that I would be at the White House. So I think it's important for those children, those beautiful children who live in this beautiful mindset of not seeing race, to understand what happened before, to guard against it, because it's still here. We're seeing it in small ways. We're seeing it in the news. I'm not gonna call it out. I'm not gonna say anything about it. But we are seeing it today. We're seeing it in a different way today. And we have to be in a mindset to understand this happened before and it could be happening now. So if we live in a society and we think that the society, everything is fine, you won't be able to see it or know it to be able to. You need to know what it is to spot it when it comes. And I hope I answered your question. Thank you, sir. All right. Well, Okay. Oh, come to the, yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't see, okay. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for the presentation. It enlightened me to the extent that I come from a society in East Africa.
What part?
Eritrea.
Eritrea, yes.
And the Eritrean people had so long oppression, and they are still under the worst dictator almost in the whole world now. I have been in the armed struggle for 5 years, but there was a confusion between factions, so I left in 1979. I'm still in a struggle with the society from Eritrea in this area. The mothers of Eritrea have a very, very weird understanding of dictatorship. I think there were a lot of Eritrean fighters who fought for independence, but now the dictator is surviving by their support because they show him that they love him. They want him to be there while their children are leaving the country in thousands in a day. So what is the best way to let them know that he is the enemy of them, instead of supporting him, to tell their children, to teach their children from the young age that their enemy is the government or the leader? So is there any one way or several ways to make mothers stand strong on this kind of situation?
Well, I don't.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oppression is a under a dictatorship is a very rough situation. You have to be very careful on how you speak out in places like that, I'm sure. But for every point, there's a counterpoint. And you have to make sure you have your facts together when you put it out, because people are going to always come back. You know, for instance, when I talk about, and that's all I do is talk about race at the White House, and I hear it so many times, you're race baiting. But when I put the facts out there, and they're irrefutable from credible sources, and if you do that, and if you present them in a way and keep doing that, people will listen. They'll ultimately listen. You just have to. You have peacefully and armed with facts. And I mean, I don't want to tell you what to do in a society where you may really be in trouble. Your life may depend on it, but because I don't want to cause harm. But I know how I would deal here. But facts, a lot of times, are irrefutable. And sometimes, in some places, when you tell the truth, there is a consequence. So you have to guard against it. You have to find the way. You have to navigate those waters. But I believe that parents have a responsibility. And I'm going to give you a for instance. Chris Darden, the former prosecutor in the O.J. Simpson trial, he's a dear friend of mine. He's in this book. And I asked him, I kept asking him and asking him, I said, Chris, I need you to give me an interview for your mom. He would never let me interview him. And you know why? He never talked to his mother about race. And his mother is in her evening years now. So to my surprise, two New Year's Eves ago, he started transcribing his interview in California while he was with his parents and sending it to me. And it touched him because he had never heard this from his mother. And those conversations are in this book. That's one thing you don't ever want to have. And I'm thankful to that my mother was so consistent that I can go into a situation and I know what she would say. And you don't ever want there to be a situation where a child is left not knowing. You want to impart, just make it organic, but make it a learning experience to a certain extent. I really think that parents have a big responsibility. And race is a piece of it because it is the deepest issue. And when you're fighting, you have to, mothers teach you influence, nurturing, care, but they also teach you how to fight. And it may be, the fight could be peaceful, but they teach you how to stand against the cruelness of the world. And there is cruelty in the world. They teach you how to stand strong silently or go out there boldly with activism, as Harry Belafonte says. And Harry Belafonte, I'm going to go back to this historic tea I had with him a couple of weeks ago. And this is about this time now. Harry Belafonte, the Deo man, the man who walked with Dr. King, who marched with Dr. King, and slept on pallets in some of these homes during the Civil Rights Movement, the Civil Rights Marches with John Lewis, the man who was under the tutelage of Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois. He said, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois, and this is for this time right now, and it could extend to your time in Eritrea. He said, this is a very important time. He said he's very happy about this time, and I thought something was wrong with him, but he very much has all of his faculties at 90 years old. He said, when I talked to W.E.B. Du Bois, he said, this is one of the greatest times because when there is such pain, and paraphrasing, when there's such pain and when you hit rock bottom, it is a time for radical activism that creates change. So that's from Harry Belafonte, one of our guides, one of our pieces of history, our wisdom, who's continuing to march. So I hope that helped you. Thank you, sir. My friend, Patty.
Hello.
Hi, Patty.
So I didn't realize this was the topic of your book, by the way, until
okay.
now. As a mother, going back to the reason why you wrote this book, mm-hmm. and having presented all these facts to your daughters, how have they taken this information, and how has it transformed the way their outlook
yeah.
on the people around them?
You are such a news person. Yeah, I can tell. Can't you tell she's a news person? Well, you know what? I'm glad you said that, because my daughters, again, they go to this this very wealthy school, and another parent is here, predominantly white school, and and they have borders from other countries, from Asia, from Mexico, all sorts of places. And the black population is not large, but it's definitely not the majority. And one of the teachers came to me because after the Freddie Gray situation, there's been a lot of, people are trying to find their way with it. Young adults can't find their way with it, so we cannot expect the children to find their way with it. So in my home, my children see that I have friends of all walks of life, and you guys know this. My daughter, a teacher came to me and said they had, I forgot what they call it, Sisters in Unity, I believe, in their school. And some of the white kids were very upset because they felt like, they said, why can't we be a part? And my daughter said, you can come, you've never asked. And the way she handled it, the teachers just said, you know, your daughter learned to diffuse it. Well, not learned, but she diffused it. And the way she spoke, it was very easy and it wasn't insightful. And I said, wow. So maybe what I've done in my home and the people that she sees that I'm surrounded by, and I don't care about race at all. People may say I have friends of all races. But I lead by example. It's not just the talking. It's how I walk. It's what I do. Yeah, I talk about, I am a proud African-American woman, and I'm not going to apologize for that. But I also love my Asian friends, my Caucasian friends, my Hispanic friends. I love people. My friends in the LGBT community, I love people. So that has transcended into both my kids. They want to have play dates with all kinds of people. And that makes me feel good, because we are a nation, and this is another piece, that is definitely browning. The majority of children that are being born today are minority children. We are going to be a nation that is going to, the majority is going to flip. So I am glad that my children see this, but they understand. They see my black artwork in the house. They see my African statues, but they also see my friends' pictures of gatherings and things that we have, and they see different things in my home. But there's pride in who we are, but there's also an understanding that we have to come together. I hope I answered that, Patty. Thank you. Hi.
Hi, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time you took to talk about this book. And I don't actually have a question. It's more of a comment because I have two biracial adult sons.
Okay.
One looks white.
Okay.
And people just assume he is white. And so throughout his life, people have used derogatory language in front of him, thinking it's okay.
Say this again?
They used to use derogatory language in front of him, thinking it was okay. Because
you know,
they thought
I have a chapter
white.
Called the N-word in here, right?
Okay, well, I'm anxious to use the N-word. Yes, they would use the N-word in front of him. And he used to just walk away, and I finally taught him. I said, no, you need to teach these people. You should say, my father's black. I take offense at that word. And then walk away, because it makes them think about what they just said and what they assumed he was.
But let me go even further. He doesn't even have to say he's black. Just say stop it, because they assume that he's white. And if they and more so by saying that, and they assume that, I think that sends more of a ripple effect. But then later on, say stop it, and then later on, maybe in another day or two, I'm black. Did you know that?
Yes.
You know, you don't have you don't.
That's a good point.
Send the punch first.
Yeah, that's.
Send the punch first, okay. And then do the wrestling.
Okay, no, thank you. That's a good point. Yeah, he did tell me recently. He goes, "Yes, I really like my making down that I'm black on job applications because they look at me like what?"
It's like he's apologetic. I'm black. Don't say it. No. Just say don't do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't do it.
Well, thank you, April.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you. Tell your son I said right on. Hello, Dr. Kumar. Yeah.
Hi there. You've established yourself as a excellent White House reporter. You've done interviews with all of the recent presidents. They've enjoyed doing interviews with you. I think you had more interviews for a radio reporter than anyone had with President Clinton.
Before you go on, people are like, "Who? How does she know? Say who you are. Say who
you
are."
No.
People are going to want to know.
I study people like April, White House reporters. And I wonder, how have you established the relationships that you have? And how do you cover issues in a slightly different way than some reporters? One of the things I'm thinking about is the black farmers.
Oh, yeah.
And the way that you brought that to attention in the Clinton administration. So how did you establish the relationships with the presidents?
How did I establish the relationships? I don't know. I'm kind of different than everybody else. I don't. And during the Clinton years, thank you, Dr. Kumar. Look her up. She's got some great books. Dr. Martha Joint Kumar. No picture, okay. When I came there to the White House 20 years ago, it was interesting. I remember some people thinking I was militant because race is not always on the radar at the White House. And it wasn't always on the radar at the White House. It wasn't. It may have been. Let me not say it that way. It wasn't always in the A block of the news, above the fold. And when I came there, they were like, well, who is this kid always asking about black issues? And I didn't think it was anything wrong with it. So I guess I stood out, and then I replaced a man who everyone loved. So I was like kind of an anomaly, this little person. They were like, who is she? So I just asked, and I was really concerned. I didn't go in there with an agenda. I was just really concerned about issues of race. And President Clinton recognized me, and I'm still known for that race book question I kept asking him for. I said, when are you going to write your book on race? He was supposed to actually write a book on race, but it didn't happen. There's a lot of things that happened. Read my first book. You'll find out about that. And then President Bush, I don't know. He's quirky, and I think I'm quirky, too. And we kind of, I don't know, and by me asking issues about the black community, and he was not known to be or thought to be sympathetic to the black community. And, you know, particularly around Katrina, I didn't even have to raise my hand. He said, April Ryan, I know you have a question. And I guess because I've established that pattern of certain issues, people know me. And then President Obama, I found it interesting. Then President Obama, I found it interesting. Before he ran for president, he invited me. I was his guest at his table for the Congressional Black Caucus dinner before he announced. I said, you can ready to announce. So I'm known as this black reporter who asked black questions. And people knew that. And if they see me at the table, that's giving them an inkling. And then for this president, Well, he did say in the Oval Office when he met with President Obama, and see, now I'm run off the mouth a lot on TV. So when he was in the Oval Office with President Obama, right after he won the election, all the reporters were there, and I don't know how I was singled out, but he turned to me and said, "Hi." I was like, "Hi." He said, "You're good." I mean, literally pointed at me. "You're good." I was like, "Thank you." And I turned to President Obama and said, "Mr. President, make him give me an interview." And the president looked at me like I was crazy. And then, he really did. And then President Obama said, "She's one of the best we have." And I was like, "Oh my gosh." So he knows who I am. But we'll see how that relationship works out. But it's been interesting to have, I mean, for me, a kid from Baltimore who's not from the Washington press pool, who's not the typical Washington reporter, to be able to be called by name by three American presidents is humbling. And then on the black farmers, that story ran for like 17, 18 years. President Clinton saw an egregious wrong after the first group of black farmers were paid out because they were discriminated against in the farm loan program. So the second group was like, "Oh, we want our money too." So he said, "Okay, you get this money," but it was not funded by Congress. So George W. Bush tried to fund it. It didn't happen. And then so after George W. Bush, I was like, "Oh my God, we're in a recession. Those black farmers are not going to get their money." So what happened, I kept asking questions, and it was always on the agenda because and that's one thing, you ask questions at the White House, it changes policy. It can create an atmosphere where people are like, "Okay, we need to put this on the table." And so I kept asking President Obama about it, and eventually the president made sure it happened, and Congress is working it out. They're now getting paid under the Obama administration. That's one thing you really don't hear about. The black farmers were actually, their case was settled during the Obama. It was a lot of money. I mean, I didn't think we could do it, but they're starting to parcel out the money now. But the problem is many of those who filed against the Department of Agriculture during the Clinton years died off. And that's the problem. So, yeah. Thank you, Dr. Kumar. Hi.
Hello, April.
Hi.
I think in many ways, what you've said about your mother's relationship with you sounds very much about the relationship you have with your daughters.
Yeah.
And I also get the sense that you don't avoid talking tough issues with them.
Mm-mm.
And the one issue that I'm very curious about is, of course, the Black Lives Matter movement. And as I'm sure you're also obviously aware of, the counterpunch to that is all lives matter.
Yeah, I'm glad
you
asked
that. And it's a tricky one. And I would just like to know to what degree and how you've addressed that with your daughters.
I always tell my children, and I'm sorry I didn't add this piece in, but when there is a problem, when you try to talk to them, you always give them hope for a better day. And that's one thing I always try to give, even though this is happening. You know, we work for a better day. I told them about complying and then complain. If there's a problem with the police, you comply first and then you complain later when you're away from the situation. But when it comes to the issue of Black Lives Matter, that's a real issue. And all lives matter. Blue lives matter. Black lives matter. You know, women's lives matter. But at the moment when there is an issue, when we are seeing these visuals, it's real. Since black people were brought over to this country in ships, since that time, we have always had an issue with policing. We have always had an issue with policing. And now what's happening, we've been talking about how we are beaten up or we are killed or what have you. And there has to be this video piece for people to believe. And I remember in my lifetime, the big piece when you have to have this video. People have to see it to believe it. And then when they see it, they still have, but it happened. Mm-hmm. Rodney King, that was horrific. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my thing is that it's real. It's not a joke. It's real. So when it comes down, I believe Black Lives Matter is a new wave of activism that's needed. I'm not saying everything they do is right. I'm not saying everything they do is wrong. But what they're doing is keeping they're beating the drum. letting people know that this is still an issue. A lot of them don't want to hear from the old guard, from the old civil rights leaders. I believe that's a mistake. I wish they would come together some kind of way, because they are dealing with our today, because yesterday is still our today. And Black Lives Matter is real. I mean, I've been profiled. I had someone pull me over not far from my house, and I thought I was doing the right thing. And a friend of mine who actually was a homicide detective here in D.C. told me, he said, don't you ever let police officers go through your car without getting a search warrant. And I'm thinking I'm doing something. I'm like, okay, look, someone at that time, someone had murdered someone not far from where I was living with my parents at the time. They had a blue Volkswagen Jetta. I was driving a red one, but they wanted to search my car. And I had on a bomber jacket and a baseball cap. I was sick that day. I just run to the grocery store to get some medicine because I was not feeling well. And it was literally two houses from my house that they stopped me and searched my car. And my friend said they could have planted something in your car. So I was thinking I was being, oh, yes, you can do whatever you want. But I didn't know any better. So I believe it's real. But I also believe I have to guide my children to understand what is the right path to take. So if they want to be active, I allow them to be active. But I said, look, if you do this, here's the positive and here's the negative. If you do that, here's the positive, here's the negative. You know, it's unfortunate that you cannot support people who are having problems at the moment without being considered racist and haters against police. I have police officers who I've dated, who are people in my family. I mean, I have very good relationships with police officers. I mean, there were police officers who came to my aunt and uncle's rescue, basically, when they were shot during the day. So I don't have any ill will against the police. I believe in supporting police, but weeding out the bad policing. There is bad policing, but there's also great policing as well. And that's what I tell my children, too. Thank you, Paula. Okay, these are the last two questions. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, April.
Hi.
My name is Virginia.
Hi, Virginia.
The mother of a black male and also grandmother of a black male child. And I would suggest to the younger black mothers rearing their children to teach them their history.
Yes.
And it does. Our history does not start at slavery. We came from royalty, mm-hmm. and this gets left out of textbooks.
And we're still royalty.
Yeah, right. But mm-hmm. we need to emphasize this more to our kids as we raise them.
Yes.
And I think that would cut down on the many youth who've gone astray. I think the statistics say that 300 have been killed in Chicago since the beginning of this year,
mm-hmm.
or shot. But these kids don't know who they are and whose they are, so we as black moms must
And there's a sense of hopelessness. We have got to give our children hope for a better day.
Okay.
We have got to let them know that there's something else out there. We've got, and I was talking to someone who used to be on the school board in Baltimore City. You know, they're now not teaching children. Children are not learning cursive anymore.
Right.
And I'm like, what?
No.
I'm like, what is that about? We have got to make them have expectations for themselves.
Yes.
And they don't. We have to teach them the way to go. And I'm sorry, unfortunately, we let our children be guided by devices and everything else. The streets are not going to take my children. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a journalism student, and I have an interesting past. I come from Oklahoma, and I went to a predominantly black high school.
Okay.
And I lived in Tanzania for a while, just with the Tanzanian family.
You do have an interesting life.
And so I'm really curious, I feel very invested in the civil and social rights struggles that we're seeing right now, and I'm curious how, as a white male, I can be a part of that without just being a domineering voice and someone who's making assertions about things, and how I can actually be a constructive part of that conversation. And as a journalist as well.
And as a journalist.
Yeah.
Well, you have to figure out which hat you're going to wear.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
as a journalist, I mean, I want to go out there sometimes and I can't.
Mm-hmm.
because it's not, I'm not objective. I want to get up and say something sometimes and I can't. So you have to figure out what hat you're going to wear. But I'm going to tell you this, and I'm going to say this, and I want you to remember this goes back to your history. And this is what I talk about in the book, and other mothers talk about it in the book, and other people who remember their mothers. You have to go back and look at history. The most successful movement in this nation was the Civil Rights Movement. And when it really had some bite, that's when white people were in it, and white people were actually dying in it. That's when people really said, okay, wait a minute. You make a difference. All of us make a difference. But when you have people coming together, not just one group, and it's sad in this day we still need, in a way, almost to have validation. It is so sad. So you make a difference by coming. You make a difference by standing. You make a difference by being here and saying that. So look back at the civil rights. Look back at some of the old footage and see the black and the white people hand in hand. Look at some of the videos pre-Bloody Sunday and then the videos post-Bloody Sunday and after. It took all of us. It took white people to step in and make a difference. The visuals play. The visual, as they say at the White House, the winning picture. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, this is the last question.
They're going to let me ask my question. Because like you, I'm probably... in competition with you with the love of politics and prose. Uh-huh. And that was a good shout out you gave them on the race panel down at Bus Boys and Poets.
I love politics and prose.
Yeah, and you made that very clear.
Yeah.
Now, where you live in Baltimore, I'm just trying to picture this. Is that anywhere near Presbury Street, North Avenue?
I'm not going to get into where I live for security purposes.
No, not my address and stuff. Okay.
No, but let me say this. I am in Baltimore.
Okay.
I am in Baltimore. People see me running through the markets, the grocery stores, and when they're like, is that really? I'm like, yeah. And I try to, you know, I am in Baltimore. Now, I'm not in the city. But I'm
okay,
in Baltimore.
But you're Baltimore County. But then you
I didn't say Baltimore
okay.
County.
Okay.
I didn't say Baltimore.
Okay.
I said
okay. Fair enough.
You will not.
Okay. Fair enough. No, I have a defender here, my friend here, 50 years plus, in the pink scarf there, who I know is going to get me afterwards. But at any rate, one of the things I did want to suggest, and thank you for your work, and mm-hmm. I've always said, you know, that you have a courage beyond what some of your colleagues have. Mm-hmm. And you have it here again, so it's no wonder that you're having the success that you're having, and I hope you continue to do so. I would ask people, and I'm going to give this as a challenge to you for President Donald Trump, is to see that he goes to the National Museum of African-American
History and Culture. All right,
I'm
glad you said
that.
Okay? I'm glad you said that.
Because, and I would say that to all of you if you have not been.
Let me say this.
Because when you want to answer the question of why Black Lives Matter, that is going to answer
Let
it
me
for
say this.
You.
And I am very much with you about that. During the campaign, he was saying a lot of things. I said he needs to see the true history of mm-hmm. African Americans.
Because it is there.
And let me say this to you. They are working hard on getting him there. And the way I understand it, Black History Month, keep your eye out on it. I just found that out today.
And make sure he goes to the lower levels.
Now, I'm not going to be torn with him. I'm not going to look.
No, that's your challenge.
No, Mr. Bunch, and all of them, they can.
It's not enough to go to. No,
I
no, no. It's
Alma
not
Rosa
enough
will help
to go
him very
to,
well.
To the president's
it
hall.
It won't be me.
Okay. Yeah, Lonnie Bunch will take care
Lonnie
of that
Bunch
for
and
sure.
Alma Rosa
but everybody needs to go. And you can't see it in one visit.
You
I
can't.
Mean, no. I mean, that, I can go a couple more times.
I will say this. I thank God
Absolutely.
For Lonnie Bunch and what
Absolutely.
He did. That basement, when you go down to the slavery piece, I mean,
yes.
the sugar, and it just blew my mind to see the fact that they had the sugar, they had pieces of the slave ship.
Mm-hmm.
They had the shackles
the
for adults.
Block.
And when they had the shackles for the children, I lost it.
Mm-hmm.
As a mother,
mm-hmm.
I hurt. I said, mm-hmm. I couldn't see my children mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. those shackles. Imagine mm-hmm. The children who were ripped from mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine the fact they come here in servitude and have to work sugarcane, and the average life expectancy, according to the museum,
and
7 years.
And rice fields and cotton fields, sure.
So he needs to see this.
And to sit in front of Emmett Till's casket.
Yeah, that was moving too.
That's right, that's right.
And at that table, at the Woolworth's table, at the counter. And not only that, in front of the KKK, the Red Grand Dress. I had a hard time dealing with that. It was like I was fighting. Right. I couldn't stand in front. I was trying to come to terms. I literally had a moment in that museum, and I've never seen a KKK outfit before, but I had a moment trying to come to terms. I couldn't get myself together.
Oh, I understand.
It was a lot.
I understand it. Well, thank you. That's your challenge, is to get him there.
No. I think it's going to happen.
You got four years to do it. Okay.
With that, thank you so much. Everyone, thank you. The book is At Mama's Knee, Mothers in Race in Black and White. I want to thank the great folks, the wonderful folks, the best bookstore in the world, Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C. I want to thank all of you for watching. And, of course, the best channel ever, C-SPAN. Thank you, everyone. I'm signing books now. Get your copies. Black History Month is now. Let's get all our copies. Give it to everyone.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.